Come now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm. If you work, be not too shoddy. Be careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Well, shiver me timbers. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network, WPRPN. Live streaming today from somewhere off the frosty midwinter shores of Korea's pre-Olympic coast, you've tuned in to episode 90 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Taking a keen interest in Norse mythology, we're joined this week by yet another one of Minds.com's more intriguing and colorful personalities, UK-based RPG designer, writer, rakish fop, and gentleman bastard, Grimachu. A self-professed atheist and non-regressive leftist, our conversation with James Desborough, a.k.a. Grimachu, promises to be both lively and diverse, as we cover everything from current events, the internet, pop and gaming culture, to his present post-mortem studio project. How about this, folks? We have managed to connect, it looks like, hands across the water and reaching out quite a ways across the planet as well, too, to the United Kingdom this week, and managing to make contact with Grimachu, a.k.a. James Desborough. I'm not sure if I have that surname pronounced right or not. Is that
close enough? Better than most people. Desborough.
There we go. So, yeah, well, thank you for dropping by. I'm glad that you took us up on our offer. Or maybe I should say that for the end. It ends up being a total train wreck. I might not be so happy.
Train wrecks are fun to watch, less fun to be part of.
Had any too many to this date, really, to speak of, but you just never know. I try to hold up my end of things and do what I feel is my responsibility as far as the production is concerned. And if the guests end up shooting themselves in the feet too many times, then so be it, I guess. But no, most of our guests have been great. We've had no problem. Like, you know, it's been a lot of great quality stuff. So episode number 90 here. Yeah. And it's a pre-recorded affair, just given the time schedules that we're having to deal with here, of course, too. So my voice is back in reasonably decent working condition. That's great. We've had to delay this conversation for a couple days up until now. So happy to have that being the case. Well, I'm not sure where we should really start. There are so many places we could dive into things here. You're based out of the UK once again, not quite as far south as one of our just previous guests we had not so long ago, Fortean Talks, who's a Cornwall, England resident. You are out of, is it Hampshire? Is a shire? It's a region, or is it a city in England?
Hampshire. It's a county. Cornwall's a good place to be if you're into Fortean stuff. There's plenty of weird stuff.
And piracy.
I know Cornwall
quite
well.
And piracy too.
Yes.
Blackbeard.
Smugglers. Lots of smugglers.
Historically, yeah. How about that? Hey, so, you know, I was just thinking about on the way home from work today, actually, and we are about 300 years now after the golden age of piracy essentially came to an end throughout the Caribbean region, of which Blackbeard, of course, was one of the more colorful figures. That was 1715 is when things kind of eclipsed, you know, kind of peaked and fizzled out, essentially. So, yeah, that's quite something for sure. Now, so Hampshire, well, you know, it's interesting looking at that etymology, too. Have you ever thought about this or realized what that really stands for?
No.
Hampshire. You know, the weed.
Oh.
Well,
I don't know whether that's what it's from.
I'm willing to bet. Because historically it was so widespread, you know, using back in the day with paper, up until like the turn of the 20th century, it was the most number one top ingredient really in all like paper products and that sort of thing. Ropes, of course, out on the seas, canvas. That's where the word canvas comes from. Canvas and sails and ropes and.
We're mostly known for our hops, cider, pigs, and forestry. That's what the county's known for. Because we have a large chunk of the New Forest, which is the biggest British forest, as far as I remember, cutting through the county. So a lot of wood was taken from here for ships. So,
geez, how about that? I'm sure, yeah, quite an amazing history. However you end up looking at England and all the characters that have, you know, emerged from the, is it referred to as the Jolly Isle? I'm not Jolly England. So
Jolly old England. Some people. Yes.
All right. Well, we've mainly got you here, of course, to talk about your gaming career. You are most known for your the production of role-playing games as well as critiquing. You've been a part of the industry now for close to 15 years, from what I understand. How did you first get into things?
Getting closer to 20 years. Let's see. That's a really long, difficult story and hard to pin down exactly when I first got involved. I mean, because tabletop gaming, you know, role-playing, Dungeons and Dragons, all that stuff, it's always had a very kind of DIY element to it. So, you know, right from when I started playing when I was about 8 or 9, I was already making my own stuff. And then in the early 90s, I started making like photocopied fanzines and things, which I would sell at conventions. I finished with school and college and that, and I was casting around for a job and there wasn't much around. So me and a friend just wrote to every single gaming company we could think of with a list of our ideas of things that we'd like to write. Freelance, and one company that was bigger back then than it is now, Steve Jackson Games, wrote GURPS and Car Wars and various other things like that. They produced Munchkin, which most people know. There's a story behind that as well. but they wrote back and said, hey, we like this one idea that you came up with, and we think we'd like you to write that book. And that was the Munchkin's Guide to Power Gaming, which was just like a comedy rip on the whole role-playing game industry and culture and everything. And that did fantastically well. And in the end, ended up spawning the whole card game and everything. But that was also the launch of my career. My writing partner went back to software, and I stuck with the gaming writing. And because that book did so well, I started getting opportunities to freelance for other companies like Wizards of the Coast, Cubicle 7 Entertainment, various others. And then as e-publishing really started taking off, I began publishing my own things as well, as that became more economically viable. So really it all started, I guess, with fan-produced material and then pestering a whole bunch of role-playing companies.
Steve Jackson, quite a big name, of course, in the world of gaming, especially, well, I think one of the Munchkins, you're right. I mean, that's one of the biggest. How many items has he produced? Like, there's just a countless number of, it's an entire series, of course. Maybe, why don't you fill listeners in on the Munchkin series then, if you would.
Okay, so originally me and my writing partner, Steve Mortimer, we wrote the Munchkin's Guide to Power Gaming. And like I said, it did fantastically well. And they asked us back to write some D20 material on it. This was back during third edition D&D. So this was around 2000, 2001, I guess. But I was busy freelancing for other people at the time, so I couldn't take that on. Those supplements didn't do hugely well, but then Steve Jackson Games hit on the idea of doing this card game, which is basically spun off our book, and that has done fantastically well for them. It's basically saved their company. But unfortunately, because that was the kind of first deal I ever made, the contract that we signed means I don't see any of that Munchkin card game money, unfortunately. Every time I see a new Munchkin set come out, especially the tie-ins like Adventure Time and Conan and stuff, I just kind of groan because, yeah, that's more money that I don't get to see. And it's all spawned from a book I wrote in 1999, and it's still going on today and making them tons of money. So, yeah.
That's bittersweet. No kidding. What immediately came to mind, analogous to people who write songs, of course, and they get screwed out of the royalties. So... And it's not too often that you manage to pull a hit song out of your hat either, of course. So although, you know, some of what we'd like to get into tonight deals with your current production of Postmortem Studios, I guess is what it's known as, along with the is it Tales of Gore, I believe is the.
Yeah, I managed to land the license to the Gore series by John Norman. That's his pen name. It's a very controversial property to work with, but it's been a fantastically successful series for a very long time. And I always liked the book. So it's kind of a dream project for me. Plus, I got to work with the fetish artist Michael Manning on the illustrations for the book. And that was another... I've wanted to work with him for years. We had a previous project that fell through, unfortunately, but then I was able to go back to him to get the art for this, and it's just everything just came together just right for that project for me, and it's one of my proudest achievements, I think.
You know, I did a little bit of legwork in the lead up to today's conversation, and yeah, controversial to say the least, Tales of Gore. So, in fact, I found a little bit written up about you, as a matter of fact, in relation to all of this.
Yeah,
there's a Reddit thread, I guess, that someone had put together. And so I stumbled across that. Maybe you've seen it yourself. I don't know.
I try to avoid it because it makes me angry and upset because people have very weird ideas about me. So, yeah, I mean, I used to try and fight back against it, but all it does is kind of feed the beast, really. So nowadays, I just kind of try and correct the record. But if there's anything you want to bring up, that's fine.
Yeah, don't feed the trolls. We definitely want to talk about and get into it a little more. But that's kind of, we're kind of skirting around a sort of heavy topic right now, which maybe, I mean, geez, we don't want to completely lose our guest after only 15 minutes of conversation. That wouldn't be good.
No,
I'm
happy to talk about anything. So long as you're fair.
Oh yeah. We're not doing like any ambush journalism here or anything. It's we just want to. It's not like, and it's even really not like a debate format or anything. We're just interested in our guests and what is that you have to offer and bring to the table. But first of all, you know, there's something that you wouldn't believe the number of times this just slips my mind. This is part of the routine here and the protocol, basically, with the Robin Hood. So in order to gain passage onto the ship, Captain Long John Sinclair, and by the way, that pirate picture that you shared with us this week is just fabulous. You really definitely having it up there for the camera in a big way. So certainly won the captain's approval there right off the bat. Yeah, for people that aren't able, well, anyone that's tuning into the show that we're putting together here over YouTube this week, just check out our live streaming slideshow and you'll be able to see James, aka Grimachu. I hope that's, is that Grimachu or Grimachu or...
Grimachu is my tag on Twitter and that, because Grim tends to be taken, but Grim is my nickname.
Yeah, that he's really getting into full-blown pirate mode there. with the Captain Morgan's rum and everything. So that's great. But no, basically what we ask of each of our guests is that they bring a pirate story that they can share with listeners. So have you had a chance to think about that? What I know the picture is pretty decent. That in itself should really be enough. But if you have a story, that'd be great as well.
If that's enough, that's fine with me. I don't know that I have any particular pirate stories.
We kind of talked about
other than pirating software, of course.
Well, yeah, that angle works. There you go. Anything, sure. I mean, earlier where you were talking about, I think, the shipbuilding industry and how historically there was a lot that was, correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't you kind of suggesting that the, like, Cornwall, where Fortiontox is based out of, and other coastal areas of the UK, they would go inland, of course, once the coastal areas had been logged, you know, just the resources had been, you know, cleaned out, essentially, that, yeah, more inland and to places like Hampshire to help in their assist in their shipbuilding efforts.
We were a naval power for so long and cut down so many trees that the traditional English oak is virtually extinct. Most of the oaks that grow in Britain aren't British at all. So, you know, there's that. Smuggling traditions, wrecking traditions, though the wreckers are somewhat apocryphal, the idea that they would lure ships onto shore at the wrong point by setting up lanterns on cliffs and so on. It's disputed whether that actually happened or whether wreckers were just opportunists who went in and looted the ships once they ran aground. But yeah, there's all kinds of smuggling traditions. Piracy, we tended to give letters of marque, so it was privateers that Britain sponsored. You know, you could kill and rob and steal for the sake of the crown. That was the point. So kind of,
yeah.
I guess we were a rogue state that was sponsoring terrorism at the time. If you want to look at it that way.
Plus les choses changent. I'm not sure if you know that expression or not. The more things change. Yeah, isn't that something? The privateers and their letters of marque. The British East India Trading Company, of course. I mean, they were the biggest. There were some bad dudes for sure. They really kind of ruled the high seas for at least a couple hundred years. All, you know, had quite a far reach as well, too. I was just listening to a story dealing with the history of Captain Kidd, actually, today, once again. It's in my MP3 player. So trying to kind of get a clearer sense of who this character was. I'm not sure if you've heard too many tales about Captain Kidd or not, but he basically, my impression and what the historians here seem to be indicating is he was a pirate hunter who went rogue, basically, and became a pirate in some ways, more or less. So although he got caught up in a lot of politics as well, too, with the, you know, the British East India Trading Company and the Crown and the wealthy financiers and backers that had initially supported his project. Anything ever heard just yourself regarding Captain Kidd?
Nope, not offhand, I'm afraid. Okay. Sorry.
You know what? I think that's good enough. I think you've done a great job there.
A yeoman-like effort.
Yeah, you gave it your best college try. Although, see, it's not really a naval-type seafaring reference, but anyways, I think
Given my specialization is games, what I can do is I can recommend a sailing and pirate-oriented RPG, which is called Beat to Quarters, and that's written by a fellow Brit who lives down on the coast and used to be in the Navy, so it's all very shipshape and Bristol fashion, and it's a very good game, so I can recommend that to people. Oh. That's Beat to Quarters by Omnihedron Games, and I heartily recommend it.
How do you spell, I'm sorry, the Beat to Quarters?
Beat to Quarters.
So B-E-A-T.
Yeah. Which is a naval command. B-E-A-T. Ah, yeah.
All hands on deck? Beat to Quarters would be...
similar.
Only get back to your, I guess, your your lodgings, essentially. Isn't that right? Get back and hit the sack?
I can't remember offhand, but it's one of those stereotypical naval commands. Wow.
You know, there's so much, too, to be learned. We did a Talk Like a Pirate Day this year. I think we missed out on things the first time around, but it's just amazing the amount of jargon and history and lore and technical information. So And really the captain here, Captain Long John Sinclair, he really, I'm not sure how pleased he is with how well that I've managed to sort of pick up on things over the time that I have spent on the ship. But really my main focus is just getting these damn shows out every week, frankly. Not so much having to pick up the jargon terms and whatnot. But anyhow, okay, well, you know what? I'm going to check the show notes here for the first time. And actually, well, even before we do that, you know, you mentioned Steve Jackson. There's two things. One, actually, I was going to bounce off you. I thought might resonate the timing of things here with what's going on in the world of pop culture. X-Files coming out with its 11th season. I thought that maybe that might strike a chord. But on top of that, Steve Jackson, you're familiar with the game Illuminati, of course. Yes,
of course.
Do you know the story behind the FBI raid on his gaming headquarters back in the early 90s?
Late 90s, I think. They wrote, I think it was GURPS Cyberpunk, which, for people who don't know GURPS, it's a fairly simple system, but very in-depth. And what it's really known for is having like supplementary and setting books that really go in depth into things. So like if you wanted to bluff a period of history or a genre or something, you know, getting a GURPS book is almost as good as getting a textbook on the subject, and sometimes far more digestible. So when they were doing a cyberpunk supplement, they were obviously talking about and looking into, you know, all sorts of real hacking information and so on. And this appears to have tripped some kind of FBI watch list or something, and
trigger
their
word.
Headquarters were
trigger
raided
word.
and computers were taken and gone over, and all this just for a game.
That's the official line, I suppose, is it not? That's the official narrative. Or there might be more to it than that. Now that's one, I guess, report. But what I heard, I don't know if you've heard this as well yourself, is that there was somebody in his employment, someone that was working for him, that they came looking for. That's the excuse they used. That was a part of the warrant, if there even was a warrant. Can't exactly recall, but presumably there was. But that's what they said. Oh, we're just looking for this this employee that you have. And by the way, while we're here, while we're at it, we're going to take all your computers and everything. Thanks a lot. You know.
I haven't heard that. I'd have to do some digging around on that. Because when this happened, the internet wasn't quite so ubiquitous, so it was a bit harder to poke around and find
was
things
that
out.
Early 90s? I mean, I think I heard you say later 90s, but I don't know.
May have been earlier. I mean, when did Cyberpunk 2013 was 89, and that kind of kicked off the whole cyberpunk boom, I guess. At least I think it was 89. And then 2020 came out a few years later, and of course now we've got the computer game Cyberpunk 2070 coming out. So yeah, it was probably early 90s then. So I mean, I think we lagged behind a bit here in the UK from the US for the kind of ubiquity of the internet. I only really got properly online in 95, though I was using, you know, dial into BBS boards, which I guess ages me,
well,
doesn't it? Before
that sounds about right. At the same time I was in university, I graduated in 95, 96. So, and even at that time, the internet was just a new thing, really. They were just kind of introducing it. It was in the first couple of years, really, that they were promoting it in universities. So,
the whole suspicion of hacking thing was frankly a refreshing change, because it had all been, you know, your Satanists and your evil up until that point, and it had been passed as book burning and that sort of thing. So, to have a panic over hacking was a refreshing change. Of course, these days it's all panic over sexual depictions and violence and triggering people and all that kind of stuff now. So it just seems like we move from one moral panic to the next
Oh,
one.
God, you've opened such a can of worms here now. Now, first of all, let me just get this just to be, you know, straight up and above board with you here. This satanic panic business, I'm not sure how that ties into our conversation at the present moment. Why that reference?
It's just constant. It's one thing after another, isn't it? I mean, you had Elvis's hips on the Ed Sullivan show that people had a panic about, and then there were the horror comics, which ended up getting banned and leading to the Comics Code, and then you had heavy metal music causes people to kill themselves, D&D is satanic, you know, computer games make people violent, and it just goes on and on. There's always something that someone's having a panic about. But obviously, because of my involvement in games, I really was there at the forefront during the satanic panic, and I keep seeing parallels in the way people get upset and offended and blame art forms and games and so on for all kinds of social ills. And it's something that keeps coming up in my career in one form or another, and it's just incredibly wearing and tiring. It just feels like this ceaseless, unending battle, especially for someone like me who is interested in controversial subjects and material.
I know you yourself described as, non-regressive leftist, but I think you've also got something of a libertarian streak about you as well then, too. Obviously, if you take that more kind of laissez-faire, hands-off approach when it comes to, freedom of expression, for example.
Socially, I'd say I'm a small L libertarian. The unfortunate thing is that the term libertarian has become associated with a very sort of right-wing economic outlook. So if you describe yourself as a libertarian, that's what people think you are. They think you're a kind of objectivist randroid of some kind. And that's not me. I mean, ideologically, I am a far-left anarchist, but I am also too pragmatic to think that that's practical. So I'm fairly liberal in the proper sense, socialist, I guess you could call me. I know that's a word salad and it's very complicated, but I don't quite fit anywhere.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the things I was going to press you on, as a matter of fact. It's not in this present set of notes. I misplaced my earlier, what I'd thrown together. And it had to do, though, with George Orwell, one of your fellow countrymen, and how he, in fact, observed how meaningless many of these labels, such as liberal and conservative, were, even back in his day. Well, like, what do we mean here exactly? So that's one thing that I'm always trying to pin people down on, that sort of Socratic approach, I suppose, really more than anything. Or just for clarity's sake, like, what define your terms? Like, what do you mean exactly, kind of deal? So
it's probably easier if I describe the principle that I'm working under rather than just throwing labels at it. So what I want out of the world is the greatest amount of possible freedom for the greatest number of people. Now, there's a problem with that because there are two competing and interacting types of freedom. So there's freedom from sickness, hunger, exposure, things like that. And there's freedom to, which is how free you are to act as you want, as you wish, to do whatever, I don't know, take drugs or own a firearm or whatever. But your freedom to necessarily impacts on other people's freedom from, and in order to ensure people's freedom from, that may impact on your freedom to. So it's a constant striving to find a balance between these two forms of freedom to find the one that gives people the most possible overall freedom. So, for example, I am in favor of socialized healthcare, which we do still currently have in the UK, though the current government's trying to get rid of it, because it's cheaper, it's more effective, and it provides for everyone to have that basic fundamental right to life and health. But it has to be paid for.
There's no such thing as a free lunch. That's right.
Yeah. So in order to pay for that, we have to impose on people's freedom to not be taxed or to be interfered with by the government in the least possible way. But so we need to ensure that freedom from for everybody. We need to impact on the freedom to of everybody to a greater or lesser degree in order to pay for it. But it is cheaper and more effective if we do that collectively. So to me, it just makes economic and practical sense to do that, even though it impacts on other people's freedom in a certain way. So yeah, you can go down the line with all these different policies and you can try and see where the balance is between the one freedom and the other one. Like on drugs, I would deregulate and possibly legalize everything because it's people's own choice. they're not necessarily impacting on anyone unless they go off driving or whatever. And, you know, we have laws about driving under the influence and so on. So we, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to fuck yourself up, you go right ahead. And we should provide medical care for people who want to kick addiction. We should have regulations so that the drugs are pure and people don't get killed by them being mixed with stuff. So on that might seem like a more libertarian stance to people. I guess it's a more classically libertarian stance, but that's because that only affects you most of the time. And, yeah, and you can go down the list with all things like that. And I'm trying to find the balance between the two.
Gotcha. You know, it's interesting referencing the, I guess, Theresa May is the current, appointee, you know, this puppet that's been put in charge, I guess a figurehead really, to serve until when exactly, who knows. But yeah, she wants to do away with something that she hasn't even been elected for in the first place to have any say in, and that she does not hold any or carry any mandate to even, it's completely illegitimate, the fact who appointed her in the first place.
Do you know much about the British political system? Well, I'm at a disadvantage.
Cameron stepped down because of a major scandal, correct? It was like a no confidence vote, which is similar in what happens in Canada.
He stepped down voluntarily because Brexit went against what he thought was the best way to go about things.
A lot of his backers lost money, I guess, then too, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I'm at a disadvantage in all these conversations around politics because I actually studied politics and history. So lots of people throw around terms and don't know what they mean or whatever, and it gets a bit grating. So our system is really not very representative at all anyway, because we use a first past the post voting system, which means in each, whoever gets the most votes gets the seat and all the other votes are discarded. So you can get a government made up of people who are in the minority of popularity, but just happen to get seats. And then whichever party has the most seats forms the government, and then the executive and the prime minister is just chosen from within that party. And typically it's the party leader who becomes the prime minister.
Canada's the same. It's a terrible system. It's a single, first person past the post. It's a single member plurality. It's terrible. Why have we not yet seen any proportional representation? So I really don't want to spend much time on politics, but I mean, go ahead. I mean, this is kind of interesting. We can have a few minutes at least, yes.
Politics is important to me, and it does influence what I do. I mean, I grew up in the Thatcher years sort of hating that, and it all feels very similar. Cameron stepped down because of the Brexit vote, because he obviously campaigned for Remain and he basically screwed it up. And everything is fucked right now. And that's why Theresa May is still in place. You know, she became the leader after Cameron went because she just seemed like the most sane and stable pair of hands at the time, which seems ironic now. So she became leader, called another election, which didn't go the way she wanted. She lost more power and became even more marginal. In any normal circumstance, she would be out on her ear by now. Someone would have taken over, that would have challenged the leadership, and she would be gone. But because everyone in government knows that Brexit is a fuck-up, nobody wants to take responsibility for it. So nobody wants to challenge, because their entire career from now on will be tainted if they're in charge when it happens. Because they all know it's a shit show, but they just support it because it won the referendum narrowly. So whoever's left holding the ball when it all goes horribly wrong, I mean, it's over for them politically. That's it. They're going to be done. So nobody wants to do it. So she's stuck there holding this poison pill until it's all done. And then there will probably be some kind of leadership challenge, or she'll probably step down, I would think.
Well, the will of the people is not being respected in any way, of course. The people voted, in all fairness, to for Brexit and to leave the EU, from what I understand. And the House of Lords essentially stepped in and overruled, pulling all kinds of parliamentary jiggery pokery, or just, you know, kind of fancy foot kind of maneuvering to weasel their way out of things and leave them so that they have something of an out at their disposal. Theresa left holding the bag, as you say.
Yeah.
What about Jeremy Corbyn then? Why doesn't, is there nothing more that he can do? Is there no other third party candidates? Just there's no other that's strong enough?
I'll try and keep this as brief as possible because I could rant for hours on politics. So we've got three main parties in the UK, though that's questionable these days. But at least as far as England is concerned, you've got Labour, which is the left-wing party, or nominally left-wing party. It's more left-wing now. You've got the Conservatives, who are the right-wing party. They used to be more centre-right. They've shifted very right. And you have the Liberal Democrats, or the Liberals, who are more traditionally liberal, a bit more hands-off, and incorporate a bit from both sides. So we used to have basically three parties, but it's only usually ever between Labour and the Conservatives. The Liberals were a rising force, and then we had a hung parliament, which meant they had to ally with the Conservatives, but Liberal supporters hate the Conservatives. So when they went into power together, all of the Liberals' traditional support basically vanished, and they lost loads of seats. They went back on a bunch of promises. It felt like they were failing to keep the Conservatives in check, which is why they were supposed to have gone into alliance with them. So they've kind of faded away into nothing. But the Liberals are the only pro-Remain party. What's weird about Brexit is that the right wing are against it for a whole bunch of reasons, and a lot of the far left are also against it for a whole bunch of reasons. The right wing tends to see it as some sort of socialist, anti-nationalist thing. And the far left tends to see it as a corporate globalist thing. So you've got the far right and the far left both hate the European project. And Corbyn is quite far left. And so he's for leaving Europe, but for different reasons. It's we're not left much real meaningful choice.
And the majority of British voters are against it as well, too. But it's just being ignored. The will of the people is being just, they're thumbing their noses. The power.
That's really complicated too. Again, I'll try to be brief. Referenda have no legal binding power in the UK whatsoever, unless the bill that puts forward the referendum specifically says that it will be binding. This one wasn't. It was meant to be a purely advisory referendum to the government for them to then decide what to do going forward. But it gained all this momentum and it was taken as being a definitive in-out vote. Despite that, it was incredibly narrow. Only, I think, 2/3 of people voted anyway. So there's a whole third of people that didn't. A bunch of people were excluded from voting, including younger voters and British expatriates living in Europe. A bunch of them were excluded as well. And historically in Britain, it's not the people, it's not the crown, it's not anything else. It's Parliament is sovereign and Parliament gets the last word no matter what. We fought a civil war over it. But the current government, the current leadership in all the parties just seems to be running scared of popular opinion and not really leading, making any decisions. Or they just seem to be too timid to actually do anything. But maybe this is enough of a political sideline. Like I say, I could go on for hours.
May you live in interesting times. Famous ancient Chinese curse. Yeah. So, yes. All right. Well, I think that's a good point then. And maybe now's a good transition moment. You can shift gears and shake things up a little bit. Focus more on the pop culture end of things, because really that's what you're best known for. That's where your passion lays and where you really put so much of your time and energy into. Not just now, of course, but over the past, how many, as you said, 20 some odd years, you've really done everything you could to establish more of a name for yourself within the world of tabletop gaming. So that being said, I know the one thing that we didn't address that just kind of passed us on by without you having a chance to really for us to really pick up on your thoughts. The X-Files, though, season 11, does that really is that, are you a fan of the series or not really?
I was back in the day until that last couple of series kind of lost me a bit. I'll probably have a look to see what the new series is like, but it was hugely influential, kind of created or recreated a whole genre, I think, of the conspiracy mystery thing. And their more hard-edged approach has maybe kind of faded into a bit more cartoony stuff lately, I guess, newer shows and things. But it was great at the time, definitely. I actually preferred Millennium with Lance Henriksen, which was done by many of the same people. That was my favorite series.
Right, yeah, that that goes back a few years now for sure, doesn't it? Is around, was it 2000 or something like that? Or how many years did that?
God, I can't.
We'll have to check that out on Wikipedia, I suppose. So any recommendations as far as torrents are concerned or TV shows, ways for listeners, this is a pirate show after all, that people can download maybe programs? Nothing illegal, of course, but I mean, then again, isn't that up to the judge to decide? You know, I'll leave it to the judge to decide if it's illegal. So
very much. And then people regionalize things, don't they? Which is terribly frustrating. You know, if you've got no legal way to watch something in your territory, then I don't think you can entirely be blamed for finding other ways to look for things. There was a pilot for a show based on Warren Ellis's Global Frequency, which was never aired, but which was leaked to the internet, which is pretty good as far as, you know, since we're on the X-Files kick, as far as mystery shows go. I use the phone ringtone from that on my phone, actually. Very, very obscure nerd points. So if you can track that down, that's worth a watch. Millennium, if you can get it, I think that was very good. Anything Lance Henriksen is in, he's good in it. And considering he's done a whole bunch of terrible B movies, I think we all owe him a debt of gratitude. So.
And for torrents, where do you go exactly? I mean, it's been a few years for me. I've just kind of given up on things basically because I can't get my head wrapped around this VPN business at all. It's just where I lose it basically. I've been doing torrents here for quite a number of years, and it's interesting. You mentioned how when we are isolated, people, whoever it is out there around the world that finds themselves isolated, you can't really blame them if they want to download content to kind of while away the hours and, you know, fill their days full of, you know, a little more, help them do whatever it takes to drive away the boredom, I suppose, and as well as provide them with not just entertainment, but information too. So, but did you have any favorite sites that you go to or forms of technology?
I don't tend to do it too much because I live in the countryside and I have potato internet, which isn't very helpful. You know, back in the day, I used to torrent things using dial-up. You know, you just leave it going overnight and hope that you had it by the time you got up. These days, I mean, it's kind of like music piracy. There's so many better legal ways to get hold of stuff. The only real reason I have to go to torrents is to look for something obscure, like old B-movies and things that people have ripped from VHS and stuff. Of course, I don't do any of that because that's terribly illegal. But if I were to do that, I would probably look for proxies to Pirate Bay servers.
Speaking of internet connections and the like, you have been pretty busy the past, I'm not sure how long it is, couple solid few months at least that I was able to just once again and doing the legwork here in the lead up to things. Via your YouTube channel, you've been putting out content almost on a couple videos a week now is what it seems. Is that right?
I try to do one a day during the week, provided I've got something to talk about, and I seem to have opinions on most things, so I usually have something to talk about. I've been doing it that kind of almost daily basis for a couple of years now. I had a YouTube channel since about 2012, I think, but I didn't really do much with it. I didn't know much what to do with it, and the internet connection here was even worse, so you know, it would take all day to upload the videos. But as things have gotten better, I've been able to do more. And then I really started in the wake of Gamergate, which I was quite heavily involved in, because a lot of commentary and so on seemed to be happening on YouTube about that. And it was something I was heavily invested in. It felt like a continuation of a lot of the battles that we'd had around the Satanic Panic and in role-playing games and so on. So I felt like I was a valuable voice to add to that. And it did get a response. So that was good. And then I just kind of kept it going since then. What I found even before Gamergate kicked off was, and this is really frustrating for me to say as a writer, but I found myself getting misunderstood a lot. you write something and people don't necessarily get the inflections or quite what you mean or the full context and so on. And you're missing out on vocal cues and visual cues of what mood you're in and what sort of sense you're conveying what you're saying. So yeah, that's really frustrating as a writer because I really like the written word. But I found that if I really wanted to get across to people, if I wanted to maintain that full context, if I wanted to be understood, I had a better chance of doing that in an audiovisual way. So slowly I found myself preferring to do videos for kind of in-depth commentary on things or talking about game design or talking about politics or history or all sorts of things. It just seems to be better for being understood by other people.
Vlogs or vlogs? Which is it?
Vlogs, yeah. I would say.
So, you say potato, I say potato. Let's call the whole thing off. a lot of really decent vlog content that you've been producing. And that's one of the things that really caught our eye from the get-go and why we decided to reach out to you. So, you know, Captain Long John Sinclair he's quite adamant, it's like, you know, that we had to at least make an attempt to have you drop by for a bit of a conversation here. But you mentioned Gamergate. Now, this is interesting because we might as well get into that a little bit. We've got a little more than half an hour here, approximately. And, you know, we'll be able to hash over and I'm sure make our way through a number of different issues over that time. But what essentially did that consist of? Was that not something that had to do with the like social justice warriors or political correctness of the feminists talking about the portrayal of women in games or something along those lines? And just how did it all manage to snowball its way out of proportion and become such a big thing?
Okay, it's a really big subject to the point that I actually wrote a social history of Gamergate and recorded it on my YouTube channel as chapters. So if you really want to get into detail, you can either listen for free on my YouTube channel or you can buy Inside Gamergate on lulu.com or Amazon. But very briefly, I mean, all those things you mention form the kind of background to it. There was this ongoing bubbling of social censorship and judgment and so on, and a hostility towards gamers from the gaming press and from gaming critics and social critics and feminists and social justice warriors and all this. That was going on for years. I got attacked by it around 2012, I think, maybe 2013, pretty badly. You know, people trying to destroy my career and get my books and material banned, that kind of thing. And obviously I'd already lived through the Satanic Panic and similar panics, so I was primed for Gamergate. But what ended up happening was for some years there had been corruption problems in gaming where the big companies will essentially bribe news outlets or threaten news outlets, like, we will not give you early access to our games if you don't write good reviews. This sort of thing. Someone I know used to work for a review site, and one time they gave a bad review to a product and it was like they'd set the building on fire or something. Yeah, people running around in a panic. They were rushed into meetings with representatives from the company, and yeah, a lot of pressure was given to increase the rating score. So, you know, that was already ongoing, but everyone kind of got used to that, that this was the state of affairs, that this was how things worked. And so while people were resentful and upset about that, it didn't really blow up. Then in the indie gaming scene, which had kind of set itself up to be very socially progressive and better than you and all of this, they turned out to have feet of clay when it emerged that a particular indie game designer had undisclosed relationships with commentators and writers at these news outlets who had given them positive coverage. And that was just like the final straw. I mean, it's not a particularly egregious thing in and of itself, but it just made everyone snap. You know, it's like, it's the Franz Ferdinand moment that set off World War I, basically. And in the wake of that, just a scandal after scandal after scandal, you know, lack of disclosure, bribery, relationships, people writing positive reviews for their friends and flatmates. It all came out. So you had a bunch of gamers who were upset because there was all this corruption and nepotism going on. And then on the other side, you had all these people painting the gamers who were upset as sexists, racists, misogynists, homophobes, whatever, rather than dealing with their actual complaints. But that narrative is the one that got the attention of the mainstream media and was pushed by all the sites which were being criticized, perhaps unsurprisingly. And it seems to have kind of faded away now a bit into a sort of facing each other over no man's land. But occasionally it still flares up. You got these two irreconcilable camps, which is unfortunate, but I'm still glad it all happened, really.
To me, I'm thinking, well, the way it struck me, at least when you're just kind of laying things out there, highly reminiscent of the early rock and roll payola days with Alan Freed. I'm not sure if that name means anything to you or not, but the way that they would essentially slip a little extra cash in these envelopes with the 45s, the little, you know, singles that were they wanted to get airplay out of, and you know, have a little bit of cash in there, payola money, and that sort of thing. So on top of that, another thing that immediately came to mind just in the last little bit that you were kind of unpacking there was immediately I'm thinking Pedogate as well, for some reason, mostly because of the way that you got these two different these two camps, is, you know, people coming at the issue from the two different sides of the spectrum and trying to own the narrative, essentially, and in doing so take whatever steps they feel are necessary to convince the public that they're right, you know, that either that Hollywood and the political establishment are filled with, you know, replete with pedophiles, or B, it's just all in people's imagination and it's much ado over nothing, just, you know, people being a little too paranoid or what have you. So what I'm getting at there, I guess, is, and I know because this is something I think you were going to address at least, but there's been a couple names that have come out recently, and I haven't been following things as closely as I should. Obviously, I'm you know, doing my best here to just live my life as I don't know. I try not to get too caught up in the whole, all the excitement and the hysteria more than anything. And even when it comes to the social media, that whole end of things, really, I'm not interested in getting all that involved. But it's always quite something to listen to people such as yourself or other just commentators or pundits that have opinions on things. So that, Steven Seagal, what a character that guy is. And Seal, I was just watching today a Seagal on Alex Jones, and it's like, oh my God. And because I'm not sure if you've looked into this or not, but I kind of have. So just a little bit, like, how can you not help it? It's like, so, what a cartoon cutout kind of character for sure. So, it's like a self parody or something. The way that, I guess, Elvis became in his old, well, his,
yeah, it's when these people take themselves so seriously and yet are so cartoonish. Right. That's what makes it gold.
But here's
gold.
The thing is that Seagal, and once again, we are getting a little bit off track here, folks, but I think if listeners will bear with us here, we might be able to come full circle. That Seagal, there have been allegations, and I think that's part of what he was trying to get out there and address today. Is that, he's quite innocent and everything, and all these innuendo. He didn't quite come out, though, and really spell things out or lay things out there, but because of his connections and ties to the intelligence world, and there's patriots in the CIA, and they're helping with this and that, and working exposing the pedophiles, and Seagal's off in Russia, but chumming it up with Putin and whatnot. But no, there have been there have been complaints directed at him by women in the wake of this whole Weinstein thing and everything else, all the other Hollywood characters. And it's not just women, of course, too. It's also men. A lot of people seem to forget that. And it's the children as well. So it's everybody, really. But let's just see if we can kind of maybe Because this Gamergate is huge. I never realized there's that whole Paola end to things. I thought it just had to do with these feminists kind of ragging out over, like losing their, just flipping their lids over the fact that they didn't like the way women were being portrayed in cartoons and pop culture and the gaming culture.
That is another big part of it. All of this kind of comes together. I mean, whether you're being bribed to say something or whether you're propagandizing something, gamers generally don't care. You know, they want to get an honest opinion and they don't want to be lectured. So both of those things annoy gamers, and nothing annoys gamers or pop culture aficionados as a whole, really, more than censorship. So the feminist side has driven more of the censorship, but it also is pushed in propaganda in reviews and so on as well. Like, someone might score down a game because of skimpy outfits or whatever. That tells you nothing about whether the game is any good or not. Yeah, it's just them making a political point. And it's also surface, this concern. It's got no depth or meat to it. I mean, I think you wanted to segue into what's been going on with Wizards of the Coast and Magic.
Wizards of the Coast, absolutely. And because I just caught wind of a little bit there, and you're the guy to talk to, as far as being able to fill our listeners in, give them a clear sense of what really is the deal there exactly. The floor is yours.
Okay, so Wizards has been a pretty good company to work for, all things considered. I mean, they pay pretty well, not always on time, but that's always the case with a lot of artistic industries. But recently, they've been pivoting, like a lot of companies have, to be more inclusive, which is great and all, but I don't think it's ever been particularly needed in role-playing games because they're so customizable and what you do with them is entirely up to you. The gaming community has always been very inclusive, very open, very understanding, very tolerant, sometimes too tolerant. But they've made this real point of trying to be very welcoming to women, people of color, trans people, all this. But it's all very surface. It's all very PR. It's changing the pronouns in a book or having a paragraph about inclusivity in the start of D&D 5th edition. And it's all stuff that doesn't really need to be said, but which people have demanded and which they've given into. But like I say, it's all very surface. Now, Wizards also produces Magic the Gathering, the card game, which has been around, 25 years now? Maybe more, and is still wildly successful. And as part of this inclusivity thing, they have been banning people for things that they have done outside of the Magic community. So if someone writes a blog that's scathing about someone else in the community or has a vlog that says nasty things about someone, even if they're not at a competition or whatever, that can end up getting them banned. One of the people who got hit by this goes by Unsleeved Media on YouTube. I think his name's Jeremy Hambly, big ginger beard. You can't miss him. And he had some nasty things to say about a cosplayer who used to dress up as characters from Magic. Nothing really too harsh, just kind of casting aspersions about her begging for money and various things like that. It was a bit nasty, made me a bit uncomfortable, but nothing too horrible, really. But because he was being mean to a lady, he ended up getting banned, and he had the whole community jump on him. He had false flagging done to his account, posts reported, his Twitter was taken away for a while, one of his YouTube channels was taken down for a while. I've been on the receiving end of similar treatment, though for far less than he did, but I still don't think he particularly did anything wrong. But are you familiar with the phrase, the wrong bastard?
No. Translation, please.
The wrong bastard is when you pick on someone or you bully someone or you try to rip off someone, and that turns out to be the worst decision you've ever made because they just turn around and they destroy you. Jeremy Hambly was the wrong bastard. He basically was left with nothing to lose and a massive grudge against Wizards of the Coast and a lot of the community. And he got his revenge basically by digging into the judges program. These are like referees for magic matches and so on. And he began digging into the background of these people and the rules and so on around who gets made a judge. And these are people who are often around kids in stores and, you know, running matches and, you know, holding semi-official positions at conventions and big matches and things like that. And he found that they weren't being screened at all in the way other people who have to work with kids are, like scoutmasters or whatever else. And finding out that they hadn't been screened, he began to look into the backgrounds of a lot of them. And he found quite a few people with convictions for, you know, sexual misdemeanors or interfering with children and things like that. And these were people who are working, essentially working, it's a semi-voluntary position, but approved by and working for the judges program at Wizards. And so he created a huge fuss about this. And they tried to brush it off and put it aside for a while, but eventually they couldn't. I mean, I think if you're going to make a claim that you're a welcoming and safe space for people, you have to follow through on that. And while they were saying that they were a safe and welcoming place for women, minorities, trans people, whatever, they were at the same time neglecting the safety of children. But it seems like now they're going through with a policy under all this pressure that means that they are going to start doing checks. But it just shows, you know, you screw with the wrong guy for the wrong reason and treat them unjustly. And quite often they can come back around and bite you on the ass.
Well, it's good that this all sort of came about. Then I guess they end up getting their the good old British expression, just desserts. So, and yeah, some instant karma there, as you say. That's how that all kind of, I guess, breaks down from what you're saying. So there we go. I think I'm a little clearer on things then as compared to when I just kind of gave that cursory viewing of the... I don't know, have you commented on this in any of your videos? I don't know if I picked up on any of that, but there's somebody else that did, and I just gave their kind of video like a little cursory kind of listen or viewing.
Yeah, I think I made one video on it. I mean, Magic isn't particularly my thing. I don't play Magic. I'm not a huge part of that community, but I do know Wizards. I do know the other things that they do. Yeah, and I keep a weather eye on the whole Geekosphere community. Yeah,
is that as big as it was
and back in the events like
is it as big as it was back in the early 90s, the Magic card game, or is it grown even bigger? Or
I would imagine it's gotten bigger, but I would also imagine that the audience has gotten older and more serious. I think that tends to happen to a lot of hobbies. I mean, nerd pastimes as a whole are doing very well, though it's harder to make a profit working in the industry, weirdly, but board games have had a huge resurgence, as have card games, as have role-playing games. I mean, you've got people streaming their D&D sessions on Twitch and stuff now, and lots of pop culture references in TV shows to games. So yeah, things have never been better in some ways, and they've never been worse in other ways.
Yeah, we do. We're doing all we can here on this end of things in Korea. We've purchased hundreds of board games and stocked our little. We have a little mini academy of sorts, and as well as just when I freelance and you know, working with the students here at all ages and levels, really. That constantly it's dice, cards, or different board games of any fashion, just you name it, because the Koreans really tend to be more, as you're probably aware, kind of computer oriented. Although it's interesting because once you introduce them to this new kind of thing, it opens up a whole a world that they'd never really, in many cases at least, known before. So it's really, yeah, you manage to pick up a few converts along the way, as it were. So, but as far as this business of kids, yeah, I mean, come on, they're the most, of course, vulnerable that there are out there in society, quite frankly. So that's great that this all happened. Obviously, it's really about time something was done, obviously, to say, hey, wait a minute, why is this getting, why are they getting a free pass here?
That aspect is really positive, but we still have the original problem that led Jeremy to go on the warpath, which is that people are being banned and excluded from games, often from careers. Yeah, like I say, I've been attacked because I like controversial material, I like controversial subjects. There's this stifling atmosphere of censorship and judgment hanging over pretty much every creative industry at the moment. But when, you know, a fan can't make a comment on his own social media, you know, outside and away from, you know, any official organized play or anything, when he can't have an opinion of his own without being banned, something's wrong. I mean, you don't have to agree with their opinion to see that that's dangerous overreach, even when it's coming from a company who in theory have the right to exclude anybody from anything that they do. It's still, it just sets off a lot of alarm bells for me. I don't think it's reasonable or right. You know, people should be allowed to be assholes up until the point they actually harm someone.
Yeah. You know, there's no disagreement here on this end of things. So, a lot of issues, I know you've talked about this in some of your vlogs, as many others, of course, have throughout social media, and, you know, people that, yeah, take the time and to, you know, they comment on these matters. So myself, I've been on the receiving end too with Facebook. It's really bad. Although, once again, as we see over in Minds, and I want to ask you a little bit about Minds.com, what you think about some of your thoughts, of course, but that they, you know, whoever excludes you from a group, they don't even have to give a reason. Really, they just did, and that's really what I found, is there's been a couple. The Asia Institute banned me. I don't know why. There's another group called the Asia Institute, if you track, look into who they are, essentially. Basically, I think it's like a CIA front group or something like that. Nothing more, like, you know, the NGO, whatever, so typical. And I don't know why they banned it. They wouldn't say, so... But and then secondly, there's every expat in Korea, and you got these like wankers that I guess are at the helm there. And he's like, "Oh, you got the power," and it's like, "Oh, geez, wow, doesn't that make you special?" So here's the, and they don't say why. There's no reason why.
There's a saying that used to be said about universities and the sort of infighting in departments. At least I think that's right. That the fighting is so vicious because the stakes are so small. And I think that's what happens with a lot of these groups and places. But you give someone a little bit of power and they feel like they have to.
Stakes are so vicious because their cocks are so small, is what it sounds like to me. speaking of controversy and the like, yeah, we want to get into that a little more for sure before we wrap here. And we've, you know, got about to the top of the hour. We can go a few minutes over, hopefully, unless you're really pressed for time. But I do want to get into this controversy, that whole end of things. Didn't really want to bring it up from the start, because with any, even the most, you know, novice interviewer knows that you save those hardball questions, the ones that might make your guests squirm a little bit in their seats till the end. So, you know, speaking of, well, we did have one issue once with an interview that we did, and it's a bit of a story. It's, but yeah, I mean, the guy couldn't answer the question, and it had to do with the business that he was running here in Korea, teaching ESL to North Korean refugees. And this whole thing of the way that one of his poster girls that he's effectively, you know, he's helped to train and teach, that she's now making $40,000 per hour in public speaking fees is what she's raking in. So speaking of, like, you know, the CIA operations and so forth, and the way that they use these people as like they're trained little monkeys or whatever, you know, to dance to their tune. And I mean, hey, $40,000 an hour, what do you want me to do? Yeah, sure. You know, a couple of things. The post-mortem studio project, I suppose Tales of Gore would be the best way to transition here as far as the controversy is concerned, and because I think it ties into Reddit, and it also ties into the way that rape is depicted in animation and cartoons. Is that not the case?
Yeah, or in anything, in fiction, in film, in writing, in erotica, or, you know, in anything.
Now, what your critic, the one critic that I can't, the report, or their position, the way that they kind of saw things, and I'm not too clear on things here myself, so you're just going to have to fill me in, but the deal is that he seemed to say that, oh, this Grimachu character is glorifying serial rape. He's making it out to be like as if it's some big joke or something. So that's just not right, and therefore we have to take drastic action, yada, yada, yada. What's the deal, essentially? What's going on?
Okay, so the fixation on this is because their hatred of me kicked off because I wrote a blog about 2012, I think, called In Defense of Rape, which sounds terrible, but it was a deliberately clickbait title. And the idea was that people would click on it and read the article, but people didn't. They just read the title. And what the blog was about the value of being able to depict terrible things in fiction. And it was meant to be a series of articles. I wrote the second one in defense of torture or murder, I think. You know, how do you have a murder mystery story without a murder? You know, rape has its place in fiction. And the important thing about fiction is that it isn't real. If you're going to say certain subjects or whatever are completely off limits, I can't go along with you. I mean, you can argue that it should be done tastefully, but that's a subjective matter. You can make all these other arguments, but it's all in the end subjectivity. And from my point of view, if you don't want to read something, if you don't want to watch something, if you don't want to play a game that involves these elements, then don't do it. Other people are capable of being mature enough to read, enjoy, project themselves into other points of view, you know, all of these kind of things. But yeah, that really stirred up a hornet's nest. And then some other things that I'd worked on, even though I've got a pretty huge body of work, they kind of seem to kind of comb through it looking for anything that confirms their biases. So I've got a couple of card games which make fun of tentacle porn, or tentacle rape as it's commonly known, and sort of from anime and hentai and so on. But yeah, I'm making fun of it. It's an inherently ridiculous
tentacle porn, and so exactly the sort of thing that you see every day, just right across the world. Plain view.
The irony is that tentacle porn started because of Japanese censorship that you couldn't show an erect penis. So,
have you heard about how in Australia now, apparently, with what is it, their porn, they're not allowed, their actors are not allowed, the breasts must be of a certain size or they're not able to perform in any of the films. Have you heard anything?
I hadn't heard that. We've got our own problems with censorship in porn over here. It's a mess. I'm involved in free expression,
expression act, a fetish towards young people if the boobs are not big enough. So I don't know, who knows what they're thinking. Carry on.
Freaking absurd. I had people going through old books. I mean, I wrote a couple of kind of sex comedy books for D&D as well, Quintessential Temptress and Nymphology for Mongoose Publishing, which were just kind of jokes meant to be sex comedies, kind of somewhat in the style of those sort of 1970s romps like Confessions of a Window Cleaner and that sort of thing. Just silly, really. But they took a bunch of stuff in that about peeping toms and stuff far too seriously. And then obviously when I got the gore license, they took that as some kind of confirmation that I was some kind of evil rapist or whatever.
Must be stopped at any cost. We must. What will it take to shut this lunatic down?
Gore has this really kind of gender politics thing where the women are very often depicted as slaves to men and wanting to be dominated and so on. But this is part of the reason that gore has always been so hugely popular, and it's been hugely popular in the kind of kink scene as well, you know, the BDSM people. I count myself as part of that community as well. And consent is really baked into kink and BDSM, and everyone understands that it's a fantasy and it's not real or true, and it's not advocating women should genuinely be kept in bonds or as slaves to men. Everyone understands that it's fiction, apart from these critics. So they took this as some kind of aha moment that I was some terrible, horrible, molesty person or something. Yeah, which I'm not. I mean, I like kink, but with consent. Thank you very much. And it's fantasy. I mean, why? why is anyone having to explain that? You know, and it's always been very popular with women, the Gurian cycle. I mean, you look at, I hate to bring it up, but you look at 50 Shades of Grey, and that's incredibly popular with a huge swathe of women. And I would say that's far worse than gore, which is explicitly fantasy. Whereas I think 50 Shades kind of plays with people's expectations, and it's got a real world setting, and it's got really, really bad BDSM practice in it. The community hates it. And yet that's hugely, hugely popular and seen as empowering and feminist in a lot of ways, which is just, I don't know. I don't.
Leaves you scratching your head.
I don't understand it.
Scratching your head, yeah.
Yeah, I don't really understand how I've become a villain by supporting sexual expression and fighting for people's free expression. You know, these used to be values that were associated with liberalism, that were associated with the left, and I'm still very much on the left, and yet I've got people accusing me of all sorts and of being right-wing for standing up for values which I consider to be leftist. It's all very weird.
How about that? You know, I think one of the slides we're going to include in the show this week is the famous quote from George Orwell that when the boot is on your throat, it's of no consequence whether it's on the left or right foot. This is talking about the power of the state, yeah. Basically. Well, it doesn't matter if it's the people often again this argument between, communism and fascism. Well, it doesn't matter if it's left or the right foot. It's the boot is crushing down on your throat is what the deal is here, folks. So, squelching or trying to stamp out your freedom to express yourself and just ultimately even exist.
The thing about Orwell is he was very left-wing himself, but he was also a very staunch critic of the left, particularly the authoritarian wing of the left. And yet these days it seems like if you take an Orwell's position of being moderate and critical and trying to moderate and temper the excesses even of your own side, they'll just call you a fascist. It's bizarre and worrying, very worrying.
Sticks and stones may break my bones. Names will never hurt me. So, and Orwell, in fact, just in his dying years, and I believe it was, did he not fall victim of, I think, tuberculosis is ultimately what cost him his life, if I'm not mistaken. But there's some people that have said that he was even maybe poisoned or murdered. But just on top of that, too, it's interesting, some scholars, people even that have written biographies of the man, I believe, have speculated on why it was that he moved to the location that he did, which was so ridiculously isolated. I'm not sure if you know about that or not, but it was so far out of the way. You had to take, like, seemingly boats and trains and, you know, like a dog of, sled dogs and God only knows what, just to, you know, buy planes and whatever to find the guy. So, yeah, he really got himself out of the, removed himself from the picture in a big way. So there's some people have talked about because he was something of an insider for, you know, inside that was the Ministry of Truth for so many years, that, you know, he kind of saw what was going on. Hence, we've all, of course, you know, read at least some, you know, or at least should be somewhat familiar with this book, 1984, Animal Farm, and so forth, and get a pretty good sense of what, you know, a lot of people said these are, he's not glorifying this. It's, he's trying, these were issued as warnings to the world and to, you know, the freedom loving people, you know, of the human species, essentially. So, but anyways, I'm not sure if you want to comment.
It's that, there's that Greek myth, isn't there, of the seer who can see into the, it's Cassandra, isn't it? Who can see into the future and tell people what's going to happen, but they never listen. And I think that's kind of the position Orwell was in. He saw all these problems and issues and did live to see a lot of them start to come about. And that must have been depressing. That must have been very difficult for him. And maybe that's why he sought isolation, just had enough of people, perhaps.
That could have been one of the reasons as well, too. Were the blind seers of ancient Greece And ancient Greek literature, weren't they not often blind? Well, did I say blind? I said blind. The seers were blind.
They were often blind.
They were blind. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what did they, were they born that way, or did, was it a ritual that they had to endure having their eyes plucked from their sockets, or I'm not sure.
I don't honestly know. I have a bit of an affinity for Odin, and he plucked out his own eye in exchange for knowledge.
We see that actually. Yeah. Do you want to speak to that a little more? Just in a minute or so, and we can kind of more as we wind things down here, more kind of rapid fire succession. Maybe run over any of the last points that we'd like to have addressed or grounded to cover. Odin.
I'm a strident atheist, but I love stories. So long as I view mythology as stories, I can find it very inspiring. And Odin really speaks to me because his quest for knowledge was completely unending. And he would go to any lengths to find things out. And as a skeptic TM, I'm constantly questing for knowledge. I love learning new things. I love fact checking. I love to understand things and to be understood. And that's cost me a lot. Not as bad as being hung on a tree and dying or plucking out my eye, but it has cost me a lot. So I feel a great deal of affinity for the characteristics of Odin as being this willing to sacrifice for the sake of knowledge and trying to be wise. I wouldn't say that I am, but it's something to aspire towards. And I'm very into sort of pre-Christian mythology because I think those tales tell us a lot about who we used to be before this kind of homogenization of culture and this imposition of other cultures. I mean, I wouldn't want to go back to genuine paganism because it was bloody and violent and nasty, but the stories are much more relatable to me than the Bible or the Quran or whatever else. They just seem keyed into the landscape. You know, I live in the south of England. I'm surrounded by woods and forest. You know, I'm walking distance from hill forts and standing stones, and you know, I'm 20 minutes from Stonehenge and so on. So this old mythology, the creatures and animals that show up in that mythology, just speaks to me a lot more.
Isn't Stonehenge located on what is known as the Salisbury Plains?
Yeah, it's kind of right next to Salisbury Plain. And most of Salisbury Plain is a military exercise area.
Oh, how's that for ironic? Yeah. The little, the ley lines, perhaps, as a lot of people have speculated upon.
Sort of thing. Oh, I've got a story about ley lines, if you want to hear it.
Yeah, we're all ears.
Okay, so I traveled to the southwest of England some years ago, determined to visit every Neolithic site that I could, because I'm fascinated by them. So I was visiting a whole bunch of them and visited one, which was this circular stone that they used to pass babies through, supposed to bless them and protect them from disease and stuff. There's a few standing stones around there as well. So I take a few pictures and I'm stood there reading the guide about it. And as I'm doing that, some American tourists show up with their compasses and maps and so on. And they're investigating ley lines and they're going on and on about how, oh, this lines up absolutely perfectly. You know, look, you know, I've got my compass reading. We've got the GPS. We can tell exactly where we are. And look, it lines up absolutely spot on perfectly with this other site, you know, several miles away. And at the same moment, I'm reading in the book how the stone had been moved like half a mile from where it originally was. So they were banging on about how everything was absolutely perfect and lining up wonderfully. And they were in the wrong place.
Did they know?
So, yeah. I didn't have the heart to tell them.
Going back to it is quite fascinating though, the ley lines and power spots or power locations, I suppose, throughout the land and the way that it's been speculated, all throughout time, civilization. You know, certain things. I mean, look at the Freemasons, for example, when they consecrate a building, and you know, and they like to try to convince us profane folks out here that it's not a religion, but there they are with their rites and rituals and degrees conferred upon one another, and you know, just these, it's just ridiculous. But, yeah, the, you know, there's all the location, you know, as the old Hollywood saying goes. So yeah, it's everything, isn't it? The energy that there is to some places, for sure.
Yeah, I'm a skeptic. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in magic or any of that kind of thing. But certain places do have an emotional resonance, the same way that music or a passage of writing can resonate with you emotionally. I think that's what taps into people. And if you say that a place is sacred, if you make it sacred, if you impress upon yourself and those around you that it's sacred, if you treat it with reverence, I think that extends out to other people as well. I mean, you go into a church or a cathedral, it definitely has an atmosphere to it. And some of that was the way the sound echoes or the light through the stained glass. But a lot of it is also how other people around you are treating it. And yeah, on a lot of levels, we're still planeswalking apes. So, you know, we appreciate natural beauty because it means things to that kind of primal level of us. I was asked to join the Masons once, but I had to they had to retract the invitation because I'm an atheist. You have to believe in some higher power before you
can
join.
That's right, supreme being. And secondly, they're not supposed to go around recruiting people. That is totally against how they are, you know, supposed to go about doing their business. And that it all comes down to this whole matter of free will. You know, to be one, ask one. So that's, and then when you do, it's like you're on the hook, yeah. Right? It's like, aha, we got you.
I think technically it was an invitation to ask. Oh, I think was the way they were going about it. So gaming the system a bit.
Pull there. So, and you're exactly right. I've often wondered about Buddhists in masonry, and they, on the one hand, I've heard stories and masons and others, just, you know, experts or what have you, supposed experts, say, oh yeah, you can be a Buddhist and be a Mason. And then at the same time, there's, as you've pointed out here, this whole matter of you're supposed to first and foremost profess a belief in a supreme being. It doesn't matter which one, just a supreme being, and we'll leave it at that. we'll kind of fill you in as we go here along the way. But but just with respect to this whole business of the sacred, profane, and certain places that have a special energy, whether it's a grove, a forest, you know, I'm sure which you've spent time perhaps walking or strolling through from time to time, given your location, even the ocean, you've made your way down to the ocean side of the British Isles at various times, I'd imagine. There's a certain feeling, most definitely, yeah. That the way the salt air fills your lungs, or the piney woods and the animals scurry about in the trees or what have you. But the fact is, everything is vibration too. I mean, just look at it from the standpoint of pure physics, and that, you know, we all vibrate at our own frequency. Some of us vibrate a little differently. That's why we, I think, get along with some people better than others, because we're kind of in sync with them, maybe. You know, they say opposites attract. There's that too, I suppose. But
yeah, something ineffable and subconscious, you know, these kind of things are really difficult to analyze and understand. But
yeah. So we've pretty much, I think, run the gamut here. You've definitely, you know, helped to basically, so that we're producing this week's episode, and, you know, put in your, what's been asked and required of you. Quick thoughts on minds.com, I suppose. We were going to ask you about, you know, gaming conventions or cosplay or Comic-Con venues maybe that you've attended. I don't know, maybe if we have you back at some other point down the road, we could lend our sights more to that, spend more time kind of hashing over those different areas. But just briefly, minds.com, just thoughts. And on top of that, we're looking for art. So, you know, any pirate art or anything to do with outlaws or rebels, you know, Robin Hood, the ship is called the Robin Hood after all. You know, we are taking all comers here and working on launching a contest over the course of this coming year, and inviting everyone to just put together their own portfolio that we can then incorporate, bring on board, make part of the what essentially we'd like to open a network store via WPR VPN and just allow the public to decide what products it is they'd like to purchase with whichever matching designs they so choose. On top of that, I should add, you are going to be receiving a complimentary network subdomain URL. All guests are entitled to that, so wprpn.com/Grimachu if you so desire, and if you're familiar at all with WordPress. If not, not a problem, but it's there for the taking, and we've got a handful of those profiles that are kind of have been put together and you know, managing to catalog and whatnot. So yeah, definite food for thought. Minds.com though, what just in a 30-second kind of just breaking things down, I guess. Give it a minute, I guess, if you want. How about that?
Of the new kind of alternative social media sites, I think Minds seems to be the most viable for me. It doesn't seem to have quite the same politicization flaws that certain other ones have. It's still got a few kinks to work out, I think. But it's getting there. The community seems to be there and building and active. You know, groups can be a bit tricky, but they're mostly working all right. It's like a kind of combination of Tumblr and maybe G Plus when it launched and was good. That's what it feels like to me. But yeah, of the ones that are coming up, I think Minds has the best chance and is the best one.
We only spent a little bit of time talking about Tales of Gore. Of course, we will add more information and links to the show notes. On top of that, we've got your post-mortem studio project, which we never heard much about at all, but we do have a link here to your postmortemstudios.wordpress.com homepage and online presence. So that's a start, I suppose, of people who are interested in finding out more about things. You know, can click on that link and throw themselves into the mix there, I suppose, and maybe reach out and get into contact with you. Any other ways that you would suggest people reach out to you and try to make contact or maybe network, get in touch?
Minds and Twitter, I'm Grimachu on both. Those are probably the best places to get hold of me. Probably Twitter mostly. I have that on all the time while I'm working. But besides the games, I also write fiction. So I have a couple of fiction books out there if people are interested in that rather than the games. But yeah, those are probably the best places to find me. The WordPress blog is kind of like my central hub where you can find everything else that I do. So that's a good place to go.
Yeah, I think Lulu.com was where some of your books, I hope.
Yeah, if you want hard copy, that's gotcha. The place to go.
Just hang on for 2 minutes here, James. We are going to transition on into the after show portion of things with the Rogues Gallery. In the meantime, thanks so much for dropping by the Robin Hood this week. Hang on. I have something coming through in the earpiece here. This is unexpected. Although, let's see what we got. All right. No, that's the wrong. No. Captain Long John Sinclair, as a matter of fact. Captain Long John Sinclair is what we have here. So let's see if, he's definitely wanting to talk to you right now. Hey, thanks for dropping by, Captain. We've got James here from England, and it's Hampshire, the Hampshire region of England.
I know the Hampshire region, that's okay, not a problem at all. Listen to the whole show here.
Well, thanks. Do you want to talk to him?
Yeah, that's why I dropped by right now.
Okay, well, you go ahead there. And what is it that you want to let James in on, or what was it you're looking to say?
I just wanted to thank him for dropping by. Really, quite the wonderful pirate picture that really seemed to fit the mold, and the greater pants out, the hat, and the Captain Morgan's rum especially there. So, just the quality of the character, type of individual that we're looking for here on the Robin Hood. Quite something, a real pleasure to have you drop by this week and be a part of things.
That's all you wanted to say?
That's about it.
Okay, Captain.
Fair winds, Captain.
All right. On that note, then, James, once again, thank you. We'll tune out the captain and let him. He's one too many quarts of rum tonight, I believe, is the issue there. So he does get a little bit frisky, though. There's no doubt about that.
Who'd be a cabin boy?
What? I'm sorry?
I said, who'd be a cabin boy?
Oh, God. I'm not even sure what to make of that reference, but that about does it for episode 90 and yet another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts. Be sure to join us again same time next Friday night, Saturday afternoons in Asia, when we share with you our latest installment of Minds.com's very own World Indie Music Showcase 3.0. So with eyes to the heavens and an ear to the ground, on behalf of Captain Long John Sinclair, the Robin Hood, and all its crew, until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. I know, there we be. Having carefully looked over each of our navigation panel instruments, checking every level, switch, dial, cable, knob, and pulley, by all accounts and indications, we indeed see it's time once again to drop anchor inside Mystic Bay and draw an end to another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts. Remember, if you're looking for a little more lively online action, keep in mind, we've likely got yet another great free-flowing Rogues Gallery After Show coming up for the next hour in either Skype, Google Hangouts, or Peer.im. Also, if you've in any way enjoyed or found yourself benefiting from the shows we've tirelessly produced over the past 2 years, you might want to drop by our Patreon tip jar page and lend a little support. Half of all network donations go directly to charity. Help to keep those numbers growing over on Patreon, and we'll be able to extend even more of a generous pirate hand. Looking forward now to the balance of 2018, we're still not quite yet booked. So if you yourself have a new, novel, intriguing, or otherwise underreported idea, unique individual, or pressing item in mind, be sure to either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com or fire us a quick email via PirateOneRadio@gmail.com. We're always open to exploring fresh creative suggestions, intriguing guest ideas, cutting-edge discussion topics, and captivating themes. You can further embark on your own personal pirate journey by either liking, commenting on, subscribing to, or just following us via virtually any mainstream social media platform, including Twitter, Facebook, Google+, or Minds.com. So don't forget to become engaged. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tally-ho.